Today we're talking to Dan Lepard, a baker from London, originally from Australia. I'm a little bit curious first about your name. It's Lepard, and I'm trying to find out where exactly it comes from. What's the origin?
I get jokes about it. People saying, you know, oh, are you the deaf leopard? Are you the wild cat of baking? Things like that. But what's the origin? My father's from the north of England, and my mother's from New Zealand. It's very difficult to justify your name.
Why did you choose baking, and where did you learn to bake?
I chose baking because I wanted to buy good bread, and I was working as a chef, and I couldn't buy good bread, so I thought I'd have a go at making good bread. And I suppose when I'm talking about good bread, I'm talking about a different kind of baking. And often, what young artisan bakers around the country, when they're talking about good bread, they're talking about a different kind of baking, and that's what we do. We're baking with a heartfelt consideration towards the soil, towards the grain, towards traditional methods. And that was something I couldn't buy. I couldn't buy anywhere. That we were still selling and still promoting bread as this commodity, a bit like a pint of milk or a pound of something. We were selling this weight of bread rather than this perfect or this excellent loaf. And I wanted to make those kinds of breads, a loaf that had these extraordinary characteristics that pleased me, you know, the sort of bread I wanted to eat.
Did you also do pastry?
Yes. I started off with the vague idea of wanting to cook in general. But, of course, you can't really cook in general. You can only really cook specifically. So you need to focus on something in order to be a good cook. I started in the pastry section, something that a lot of the contemporary restaurants that we saw spring up in the late 70s and early 80s would move their young chefs through from the gamanger or from the salad section through the pastry and then end up grilling a piece of meat or fish. And I didn't want to grill pieces of meat and fish. I wanted to stay doing the more sort of complex science stuff, I suppose, that occurred around the pastry section. And the pastry section was where I had lots of flour and yeast and all sorts of things to play with. So I think I was drawn into pastry, but then very quickly, actually, within a few months of starting that, I had an inkling that bread baking was what I wanted to do.
Yeah, because I think in food you can manipulate whatever you're working with, fish or meat, to a certain flavor, and sometimes it won't come out right, or you can mask it or something, but pastry and baking, it's more scientific, and you really have to, you're sort of the slave to the master, which is the product itself, especially with bread baking. Is that right?
Yes, and especially with something they call in France the boulangère's pâtisserie, the sort of baked pâtisserie. What you'd call in America is home baking, really, where you put a mixture together, you place it in the oven, you let it bake, and when it's baked, it's cooked. I mean, you may ice it, you might vaguely decorate it, dust it with icing sugar, but essentially it's this bound mixture that's sealed in the oven. And that excited me because, as you say, there's so much that can go wrong and there's very little you can rectify once it comes out of the oven. I mean, you can sometimes tart it up with a little naughty coating of something. But otherwise, if it doesn't taste good, you're stuffed, really.
Bread in itself, it's a living thing. It's not really like, we're dealing with dead pieces of flesh and dead fish.
That's very true, but that's also the change that we saw happening in contemporary baking. I think up and from, certainly in post-war America and post-war England, we saw bread as almost like a polymer dough as a polymer that could be extruded or extracted into forms. And we took a lot of pride in the industrial baking, really, because we liked the fact that we thought we were alchemists. We thought that we could produce this food out of nothing. Now, modern bakers don't think that. Modern bakers don't think of themselves as alchemists. They see themselves as combiners of natural ingredients. And what we try to do is not change the nature of the flour or change anything, but actually try and keep it whole, keep grains whole, keep flavor whole. So we say with a sourdough, we have this wonderful starter, and what we're trying to do is encourage and keep that flavor from the starter all the way through to the final loaf. So in a way, we're sort of dough guardians, I suppose. We're more like a brewer who nurtures good ingredients together into this final wonderful beer.
That's kind of funny because I've heard it said before that a beer is sort of the liquid bread without the flour, and flour is the essential.
And you still see in Europe the links between beer making and bread making. There's a strange drink they have in Russia called kvass. Now, when you look at modern recipes for it, it's made with rye bread that's put back in water and left to ferment, and that becomes this re-fermented beer. But traditionally, kvass was made from, it was sort of a modification of the beer-making process, where rye flour was whisked into a scalded mixture of malt and hop liquid, sometimes using malt from rye grains as well. So really, beer and bread sleep very closely together, I would say.
They both taste really great.
Absolutely, and they taste great together. I think we have lots of pubs in England that are struggling at the moment because people don't drink as much beer at lunchtime and drink as much alcohol, and I think we should be turning them back into good bakeries so that there's beer and bread together in the local pub. I think that's
yeah, it's kind
go.
Of like when I was in Germany with the beer and pretzels.
Oh, absolutely,
a great match.
Yeah. But I think we should bake them there too. I think that would be wonderful. So that you've got an excuse to go down to the pub in the morning to buy a loaf of bread, I think. That's a good thing.
Actually, I want to talk to you a little bit about rye and spelt, you know, being like the original grains in the world, I guess, and how it kind of recalls our peasant origins, and how with industrialization, everybody tried to make like white bread because the rich, I guess, wanted to have something that was not colored and full of flaky bits of grain.
Well, generally the rich always did have white bread because they had the money to waste the grain in order to sieve out the endosperm in the wheat flour. But really it wasn't a push by the rich, it was a push by the poor. It was us wanting to not be poor and to escape poverty. And the draw towards white bread was an escape from poverty. And really, the push during the industrialization during the 1800s was to escape poverty, was for the working and middle classes to get away from a desperate poverty that was around. And I believe a lot of the industrial bakers, certainly people like J. Arthur Rank, whose Hovis loaf was seen, like Dr. Kellogg, as being a wonderful loaf for people to have. Industrialization was sometimes seen as, we see it now, as this demon, but there were many people involved that had their heart in the right place. It's just that the consequences of taking the labor out of the process were quite devastating, and that's really the problem. But it's something we're starting to rectify now. But the challenge for the future is encouraging all people to eat healthy food, to eat closer to the soil, to enjoy whole grains, and to just to have a diet that their body needs rather than one that television tells them they should have.
Do you think that organic foods can compete with all the quick technological ways of growing food, the myriad of terrible things that the industry tries to do to make food more perfect, more changing?
Absolutely. As long as we embrace organic production as the responsible way that we all should act, it's really about responsibility. I think one of the silliest things we do is try and promote organic as a flavor choice, to say that you as the individual gain immediately if you buy organic food. And that's not true. The reason we should support organic farming is to help our children, to help our children's children, to keep the soil clean, to keep nature as nature intended. It is our responsibility to do that. And I think where we feel that we can now lead our lives without responsibility, and I think we have to dissuade people from that view. We have to show everybody that they need to care for their local community. They need to care for the soil. They need to care for the air. It isn't really about government so much as individuals. We need to use our cars less. We need to spend less energy. And organic is absolutely a part of that. But to suggest that it will taste better, I think that's a mistake.
It's a sort of a way of going back to what we originally were. I think we've speeded up so much everything in life that we forgot the really good things like cooking and sitting down with your family enjoying good food.
Well, absolutely, Jeremy. I try and explain organic as the old-fashioned way. Organic is the traditional way. And I do find a lot of the older members of the community quite resistant to it because they feel that organic is a rip-off. Organic is a way of cheating them. And I try and explain organic is the way food was produced when you were a child. That's all it is. You need to see it as the old-fashioned way and also the right way.
In terms of your using hands-on methods to do baking, are you doing that basically for all bakers in general? Because, you know, I read on your website that, you know, industrialization, you know, isn't bad to a certain extent, that you could pump out 10,000 loaves of bread, but, you know, doing it by hand, it would seem quite a bit of a chore. But I'm sure that's how people used to do it.
I'm not sure that reducing countries or reducing large cities to one or two mega bakeries is the way forward. In fact, I think you might argue that it just doesn't work. It doesn't give even retailers enough choice. Really, the way forward are lots of smaller bakeries. Now, smaller bakeries do need hand techniques as well. Sometimes even with the larger bakeries, we always imagine that they're all fully mechanized, but often it's just lots of cheap labor toiling their hands away to produce these loaves, even these hamburger buns that we see. My work varies between teaching these hand baking techniques and baking science to home bakers and bakery industry staff who want to know just a little bit more about what their bakers do, to teaching perhaps more specialized methods and techniques to working bakers who are often too busy to take time off and go on a course or spend time with another baker. I think it's about getting information out and to bring education back as an important and proud thing that we can have in our industry. Up until the late 70s, so there were so many really good baking books produced for working bakers, and now there are very few. In fact, the best one I've seen lately, which I must rave about, is Jeffrey Hamelin's Bread Baker's Book of Techniques and Recipes by Wiley. It is quite an extraordinary book, and this is one I want to recommend a lot for bakers in the UK.
I was really fortunate to actually go meet him recently at a demonstration he did close by to where I live, and he had some breads that I was just amazed. He's got a full box of treasure troves of recipes and stuff in that book, and I really recommend it too.
Oh, it's a tremendous book.
I have your book. You advocate shorter mixes and shorter rests, and some people actually do, you know, a mix in the machine that will be, you know, 2 minutes, 3 minutes at a quicker speed, and then the rests will be longer, and then you have to fold in the dough to, you know, oxygenate it. What is your difference, and what's the difference in your method?
I don't think my method is different, actually. I think what I'm trying to encourage people to do is to bake according to observed changes in the ingredients or in the dough, and to mix until you see those changes, or to allow time for changes to occur. We've often removed observation from method. We're asking people to follow a list of instructions, but not asking them to react to changes that they observe in ingredients. I must tell you a story. I was at young pastry chefs at one of our top restaurants were making a creme anglaise, an egg custard, and they would bring all the ingredients to the boil, then they would put it into a liquidizer, and they would blitz it all together, so puree it until all the curdles were smoothed out, then they'd add a bit of cream to soften it. And my pastry chef friend said to them, "Why do you make it that way?" And they said, "Well, that's the way we were taught to make it." And he said, "Well, there is another way where you can put all the ingredients together and stir them very slowly, either in a bain-marie or very carefully over a low heat until they just slightly thicken, and then pour that into a container and chill it." And they were quite astounded that there was another way. I think sometimes we've just been teaching people rather bodgy ways of doing things, rather than teaching them that they have to take time, they have to be patient, and they have to be careful. I think when you remove skills and time from a process, there will be consequences and some loss. And I think deep in our mind, I think we all know that. Yet, often young bakers will still run after the first person who says, you don't have to bother applying care and attention to this. You don't have to be patient. You don't have to practice before you become good at this thing or that task. And I think we have to dissuade them of this. We have to teach people that the best result comes with care and attention, with watching what your hands do, with watching what happens in front of you. And in the long term, it is quicker that way because you make less mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, bread, especially because of levains and sourdoughs, you have to really watch what you're making because there are time constraints, temperature, and everything that can really foul up everything.
There was a journalist talking to me about how you can relax through bread making. And she'd been talking to one baker and who said, oh, it's so, you know, tremendously relaxing because you can knead a ray vigorously for 10 minutes and you release all that tension from your body. And I said, well, I don't make bread that way. I find it very relaxing, but more in a sort of yogic, sort of calm way. You know, good baking is almost akin to a religious thing, I suppose. We work carefully and considerately. We measure things carefully. We mix them slowly. We watch them. We nurture them until we have wonderful dough to make a wonderful taut loaf at the end. And to me, that's the spiritual part. It's not a sort of aerobic release of energy after going for a run around the block. It's something much calmer. And all of the bakers I admire around the world tend to take that approach. They're much more calm. They're not really as turned on by lifting a 50-kilo sack of flour as they are for saying, look at this dough, look at the texture, look at the aeration, look at it, smell the gentle sourness that comes off it. Those are the phrases and words that excite me. And that's what we need to encourage. And I think it works. I think young bakers are encouraged when they hear words like that.
It's very sensory, especially since I've tried your method of actually working with my hands instead of using my KitchenAid. And it's a lot different. You really know the dough. You know what the feelings are, what you're supposed to look for. And, you know, I mean, you could read the book religiously, but still you're there with this mass of dough and you're saying, okay, what's happening?
Oh, absolutely. And you know what it's like, I'm sure. You're living in New York. I'm sure we all have sort of tiny kitchens and we don't have room for lots of equipment. So we've got to, you know, by the time you've got your coffee machine and your juicer and your this machine and that machine. And I just thought, do people really want to have more machinery in their kitchen? How about hands? I really enjoy making bread by hand. I really enjoy baking at home. I enjoy when I'm in a commercial bakery, sometimes just moving away from the machine and mixing with my hands.
And can you produce great bread at home, though? I mean, is it much different than a bakery? I mean, there are certain things like the steam will create a beautiful crust that you won't get in a home oven, I guess.
If we see the crust produced by an oven that has steam injection as the best crust, I think we have to ask whether that beauty, if you like, is slightly deceiving. Maybe it isn't always about the external appearance. I mean, I love the bread from Leonor Poilin, but if you look very closely at the crust, it doesn't glisten, it doesn't shine, it doesn't have tears that lift majestically across it. It looks rather humble. It looks like almost like a flat stone with a monogram, and inside it's beautiful. It's fragrant. It has a lovely sort of gray brown color to the crumb. I think it's gorgeous, but it's nothing really to the external appearance isn't anything to write home about. I think sometimes we have to let go of preconceptions about what produces what is the best crust and look at what is the best crust we can produce from our oven. Otherwise, we're constantly disenchanted with what we do, and the way forward is to accept what we do and make it a little better.
And to enjoy
work. Yes, it is food. And I think bakers forget that we're producing food. It is about food and it is about how we enjoy it, how it tastes, how it cuts. You know, it's things like that. We're not producing pottery. It isn't really about the external appearance so much as the crumb and the flavor of the crust.
Are bakers on par with chefs in the world? Are they, I mean, chefs have sort of an identity now of being stars. Bakers, I think, are a little bit more in the background and less concerned about being stars.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes, chefs are stars. They're the sort of monarchs, if you like, of cooking, whereas we walk along the streams with the fishers, if you like. Bakers are more journeymen who are much closer to the soil and the land. We should be proud of our simplicity and play up to that. So often we're bombarded with chefs that are very keen on their promoting the power and the glory that they have. But I think we need to be proud, too, of the simplicity and the good food that we can conjure with relatively simple ingredients.
Speaking of which, if you were asked to do a party for the Queen of England, let's say, you had an unlimited budget, what sort of pastry or bread or food would you want to prepare for her?
I would like to show her a very simple loaf of bread made with grains grown in England. I would like to mix it simply, maybe with water from a particular river or stream or well. Or I'd like to present to the Queen a loaf that had an honest majesty in it, if you know what I mean, a sort of an honest representation of something that was majestic inside it. And I think the closer you can get a loaf of bread to reflect the soil and the land it came from, the better. Pastry, again, I think I'd like to make a simple sort of apple tart using again, perhaps some grain grown in East Anglia or Kent, milled locally, a little water mill or windmill, using some good English butter and some apples from Kent, perhaps. I'd like to present to the Queen those things, rather simple things. And I'd like to think in my heart that she enjoyed it.
So if you were constrained by 100 euros, let's say, to make a similar sort of setting for her, would it
I think it would be. But no, I think
it's
the question of more, what if you had 100 million euros? It would be the same. No, I think I could do both those things for 100 euros. I don't think it would be... it would be that hard. But that's part of the magic that we have. It's not that we're alchemists, but we're able to create wonderful foods for very little cost, you know, for some grain that's harvested, some local grain, which unfortunately grain doesn't have a high value in our community. I wish it did. Even at its most expensive, the rarest flowers in Britain are still cheap compared to everything else. And that's a shame. I think we should appreciate it more. So when people, I'm mortified if people complain about the price of flour. I just can't imagine what they consider expensive is if they consider the price of a small pound bag of flour is expensive. It's silliness.
So there wouldn't be any difference then if you were preparing for David Beckham, perhaps, then? You think you would be giving him the same sort of treatment?
Oh, absolutely, because it is a single food for all. It is a food that I do imagine everyone would like. I'm the silly one. I couldn't believe that anyone wouldn't like that. Often a lot of the mistakes I've made in my life have been because of that I just imagined that everybody would like that. I imagined that everybody would like a simple apple tart and some good cream. I imagined that everybody would like a lovely loaf that tasted of rye and wheat and vaguely sour, but, you know, with a good hearty crust.
My two chefs that I spoke to recently had spoken the same thing, ingredients first and flavor as being really important to bring out what the ingredient is.
Absolutely. I do see part of my work in Britain is encouraging bakers to care as much about the source of the ingredients as they do about the effort they put into using it. Sometimes bakers want consumers to spend good money on their loaves, but they're not willing to spend good money on flour from local producers. I would always encourage any baker to use the mill closest to them, to look at what's available locally and make the best of that. Sometimes I'm caught in a bind if I'm working with an Italian chef or a French chef who wants to use lots of imported ingredients, but still I try and encourage them to be Italian with local ingredients or to be French with British things. Because that's what you do in France. You know, good chefs in France make the best of local ingredients. If you want to be in the style of a good French chef, you make the best of local British ingredients.
On your website, you wrote about visiting back home in Australia. Can you talk about the differences about baking there and in England today?
The biggest difference is the level of capital in investment they make in their bakery, before they begin work. In Australia, bakers cared terribly about the oven they used, about the mixer they used, about the source of the fuel. And that is something that's only just starting to happen here. I do believe it's oven builders like Alan Scott, a fellow Melburnian, who has made big changes to the way bread ovens are appreciated. Wood-fired bread ovens are appreciated in the United States. But we're only just starting to see wood-fired ovens used in bread bakeries in the UK. The difference in Australia was that there was much more of a Rudolf Steiner-inspired influence in baking there than there had been here. Steiner was very concerned about biodynamic agriculture. That is, it's organic with knobs on. It's caring about the conditions in nature around when the seeds are planted. And that has absolutely affected the path that craft baking has taken in Australia.
Do you think Australians and New Zealanders absorb flavors or styles because they're so far away from the rest of the world that in some way it's, they're more adept at turning it into their own style?
No, I think it's a combination of the slight chippiness that a lot of Australians have, that there's always this fear that they're not as good as the rest of the world. So they work extra hard, they really try harder, and they're determined to be first place, but they always feel that they're slightly second place. So they put extra effort in. One of the successes is the limited choice in flour that they have. Here in Britain, we have so much flour to choose from that's imported from all over the world, all over Europe. In fact, so much flour to choose from that we don't know how to use any of it properly, because we just dabble from one bag to the other and we never get to grips with anything. In Australia, they have so little choice in what flour to use. In a way, like it was for the organic bakers who were starting up in the 60s and 70s in the United States, who didn't really have a choice and had to make the best of it. And because of that, developed techniques and skills that really produced world-class bread very quickly. I think it's, in a way, the poverty of the ingredients that has forced them to be good, rather than a vast choice of ingredients. I think in Britain we have too much of a choice, and that is the reason we really don't try hard enough. However, what I try and put across on the website is that it is time now for the bakers in Britain to try a bit harder and to raise their game. You know, there's so much that can be learnt from bakers in America, in Australia, in France and in Canada, that I think we need to take advantage of that and share and get better at what we do.
Well, there's a baker that's on your website on the forum, Mick, that I really appreciate.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's made some terrific breads, and I've seen his pictures, and so I try to emulate him as much as I can.
Mick is very special. Mick is extremely talented, and gosh, if we had 100 Micks in Britain, all with bakeries producing bread, we'd be in a very good position. He's tremendous, very, very good. Now, the forum bakers are great. There's a guy, Peter Cook, who has a bakery out in Ludlow, who's very talented. There's a miller, a guy called Max Clover at Clover Foods, who's very good. There's bakers from Mexico, from Spain, from Poland, from Australia, Malaysia, and some, like yourself, from the USA. I feel very proud that I could just put something there that let people talk with each other, and I learned so much from them as well. They're really,
yeah,
really
good. Yeah, because I find that even in books, you'll get the wrong information, or a lot of pastry chefs in particular don't like to share their formulas or recipes. It's like a guarded secret. So to have your site was like a real pleasure, and I just happened on it because I'm always looking for bread sites. They're great to find.
If you're interested in sourdough baking, there's one that's just started up in Australia. I don't know where it's based. He maybe up in Queensland. I'm not quite sure, but the bakery's called, it's www.sourdough.com.au.
Yeah.
And it's worth visiting there. It's a great website.
Yeah, I checked it out, and they had this really cool bakery, the Bavarian Bakery. And that's
beautiful.
One of the things that I find here, like a really a resistance to try different sorts of bread. There's sort of a bias towards French or Italian style bread, whereas nobody really does German style or Northern European, where you talk about it in your homemade loaf. You traveled and did your walkabout there.
Yes, I think part of the problem is it seems difficult to get books published in the United States that aren't self-reflective, that don't talk about, say, German bread through the eyes of a German baker in Milwaukee or Swedish bread through the eyes of a Swedish baker in San Francisco. I'd like to see a little bit more of that coming out in American books. I would like to see them, you know, talk, really visit the rest of the world and bring back ideas, rather than to see them within this self-contained, wonderful, but enclosed U.S. baking community. I think there's a lot to be gained there. It's a lot to be there's some great things to see how Jewish bakers work in Poland. I think it's interesting, rather than how a Polish Jewish baker works in New York City. And I know, as an immigrant, sometimes my memories of Australia or my memories of my homeland don't quite equate with what I left behind, what I really left behind. And sometimes it's worth going and checking out how close it is, rather than simply presenting the hybrid New World food as typical of the homeland.
What's your next project, actually? What are you working on now?
Well, ongoing projects. There's a book coming out, actually, with a few chefs around the world, with Charlie Trotter in America, with Peter Gordon, with Pierre Hermé, a pastry chef in Paris, called The Cook's Book, which comes out September the 20th, I think, both in America and here. And that is a huge 600-page compendium, step-by-steps from some very talented chefs around the world and myself. That's very exciting. I've got a big book coming out on British baking, but that won't be out until spring 2007. I feel like my life is written away years ahead. I would hate anything to happen, but there's that. A little bit of photography.